When I was 33, trekking deep in the Adirondacks as I do almost every year for 30-some years, a bolt of lightning flew down into a great hemlock tree under which I was briefly standing for respite from the rain and blew its upper half into shards and jolted its million volts down through that tree and into the body of the lone hiker standing at its base. That blast flung me from the tree. Sure that this was death, I bellowed out, "No!" to all existence. It was an idiot mistake. It was against my son's being cut off from a father he would never know. Yet in what might have been 1 second, I knew that I was alive. And then there thrilled through me a pure substance of joy like I have not experienced since or before. The reality of being, that's all it was. There's no more words perhaps possible. The absolute gift of the reality of being. And the next instant, I became aware as I tried to sit up that I was paralyzed from the legs down. And then this joy flew higher. It was like uncovering the palimpsest of some unutterably beautiful work beneath the obscure and muddy oil of my pained body. I was being. Now, this took place just days before the opening of my second year of training in seminary. During a full hour when I did not know that my paralysis would pass, I was sitting in the mud resolving how I would make my school's jungle of stairways work for me. I was going back. And when I actually got to the school about a week later, I was walking, but with a very heavy limp. The lightning ride had tried my body sorely. And as you imagine, perhaps, when someone says to you, "How are you?" as an end of summer greeting, "And are you limping?" the answer is not short if it includes the phrase, "I was hit by lightning." Now, my fellow students were earnest Christians, every one of them. And when they heard the story, they would offer thanks and prayer and gladness for my health and healing and for all the people that I've left out of this story who helped me, starting with the doctor I had just seen at University Health, all the way back up along the roads and into the mountains to the man who had taken me from the trail where I had labored. And also thanks for that irrepressible demand for life that surges in all of us and did in me when I was up under that tree. Their prayers fairly retold the whole story of what had happened to me step by step, but no one offered prayer of thanks for the bolt of energy that broke that tree and me. And this felt to me like a hole in our prayers. It seemed unfaithful not to be complete with the prayers, to include everything. It seemed like a line of easy music in an otherwise great symphony. How can prayer be holy if its thanks and asking touch only what we like or would like if we had it? How can that be holy? What if God behind the God we think we love is hiding almost anywhere but where we wish her, even waiting especially in the valley of the shadows of death? Let me say plainly that I in no way believe that God designed my relation to that bolt from above. neither to punish, nor to warn, nor to protect me from its fate by, say, diverting its course from my heart, where a few minutes' paralysis like that in my legs would have prevented you from hearing this whole story. Faith in God as I know it, as it has come to be meaning for me, has very little to do with beliefs. Rather, faith is a desire that I experience. It's a yearning, a pressing forward for the upward prize, as Paul calls it, a yearning that my God be the God in all things, through all things, beneath all things, the God behind God, as Meister Eckhart put it 700 years ago. I desire faith in this sense, this experience, so that by grace I might grow less and less anxious only for what seems sweet to me, that I might more and more through my prayer, in the words of Brother David Stendhal Rost, so attend to what is given that it appears as a gift. For even the darkness is not dark to thee, says the psalmist. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with thee. Can we heighten this theme today, this Lent? We Christians commonly assure one another that God or Jesus will answer every prayer, that every sorrow will be consoled with joys, every tight circumstance eased, every disease of body repaired or even cured, every wrong done to us righted. These are common assurances. Every guilt forgiven. Even sometimes we are assuring one another that we are being divinely protected from harms to our body and soul every instant by providence or angels. I hate to be too blunt, but to me, this kind of talk sounds like clubhouse code that we needed when we were 10. Say it or you can't get in. But no, I won't say it. And I won't go in, not to a faith so bound in fear to fantasy. You can feel the childish character in, yes, the beauty of a child, to be sure, but nevertheless, the childish character that demands promises of safety, love, and acceptance in every valued relation to both things and people, and which shuts its ears to the edgeless evidence of guilt and evil fate that bared down on the thousands and the millions. Perfect promise is not the word of our God. The Bible tells you so. We might rather call our Bibles the word of the broken word. Think of its opening myths of Adam and Eve cast into the garden. Think of Cain killing Abel, of the nations scattered by God's wrath into misunderstanding myriads of languages. Think of Pharaoh's broken words over Moses and the people. Think of Saul's deceit and David's deceit. Think of Judah's death struggle with its belief that it had been promised an eternal kingdom under David and his sons. Think of Job, a story in which the man's faith is so ravaged, as is the fabric of his life, that his friends cannot regard him. This is the word of the broken word. Think of Jesus, betrayed by Peter 3 times, betrayed by the sleeping disciples 3 times, betrayed to death by Judas, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Let us not move hastily to the storied solutions for each of these suffering servants. Before we get to solutions, first of all, our word is the word of the broken word. Let us remain here for a while. Let us stay here because some of you are now in the middle of your life here, in the midst of the broken word. There appears no crossroad on your horizon, no opportunity wonderfully cooperating with the crisis. No option out, no opportunity, but only the road and your burden. Let's stay right here for a while. Betrayal, it usually presumes a wrong has been done that ought not to have been done, a cruel choice on someone's part. And for that reason, disease and accidents and natural disasters and even perhaps being let go from your employment seem not to belong to the subject of the broken word. Of betrayal. Where is the cruel choice and who is the cruel chooser in these things? But let us stay inside the experience of being cut off from your hope, from your expectation, from health. There, inside the experience of disease and calamity, the anguish from the dislocated bones of our life feels hardly different from the wrenching betrayal of trust. It all comes out as a kind of a break. This is because mostly we live as if a word of promise has indeed been spoken to us. Doesn't our health, if we have it, feel like a given? And if given, then promised, at least for today. Right? Isn't that how we actually live the day? Isn't the solidity of the asphalt underneath our cars, the hardness of those straight rails over which the metro cars pass swiftly, like a kind of word of assurance that the world is trustworthy? We don't think it or thank it moment by moment, but we live it as if it were a kind of a promise. So even calamity, when breaking in to our cars, crushing bodies on the rails, is a betrayal, a breaking of the word. No cruel chooser need stand behind these events that break our bodies and our loves and our hopes. These feel the same as betrayals of trust. We feel the promise of our life broken. We hear a broken word. Our culture tries to strum an easy tune to prevent us from listening in to the threat of the broken word. For our guilt, we hear the tiresome mantra, "You must forgive yourself." Did you ever try playing checkers with yourself? It's about the same ease of accomplishment. For our fear of insignificance, we're coached often these days to imagine that our gifts can change the whole world. Me, personally, can be involved in the change of everything. And there's an excitement in that. But it doesn't touch our anxiety about our insignificance. And for the terror we have at pain and losses of every kind, we pay armies of lawyers and doctors and entertainers to support the illusion that our rights and our long life and our pleasure might flow endlessly on like an unbroken word. So much for culture. This is not the Jesus story. Oh, in haste we can fly up to heaven on waxed wings that God has not supplied us with and see it all from that point of view if we want. But the Jesus story is, first of all, the broken word, the no way out word, the necessary surrender which American ethos wants to hear no more of. And maybe some of you want to hear no more of. But if you are in it right now, if someone you care about is in this now, in the grip of doubt and meaninglessness, in the grip of shortened powers and lost hope, in the grip of guilt relentless, you want this word. This Bible word. You taste a thirst for one God in all things, not a God for the good days and a God for the bad who differ. Throughout my ministry, for those who seem ready to hear, who wanted to hear, what I take to be here. I have worked to dismantle weak and unstable terms for faith. No, faith does not mean, need not mean, believing that God breaks the laws of nature in order to rescue his beloved. That branch can be broken. Let it break. Faith does not mean believing that Bible stories all accurately record what a video camera might have seen. That branch can be broken. Let it break. Faith does not mean that you suppose that you will live forever in your skin, so to speak, with your best beloved ones in bliss. That branch can break. Let it break. Faith does not make a magic shield. The word will break. Let it break. Where does this stop? Someone says. One of my elders came to me years ago and said, "This feels like the floors of a house that I had been dwelling in, and the floors are breaking, and I'm coming down, I'm crashing through floors where I formerly believed." Where does it stop the breaking of the branches of broken words down, down from the treehouse of childish safety and the secret code words? Is there an end to how much you can lose? You know, if one terribly fears that life will take too much away, he is tempted to press religion into a kind of service as a secret code for all the imaginary comforts. But if you let things fall where they may, if you trust that there is a God whose gift is not the ordinary kind of foundations on which laws and things are set, if you accept the broken branches and the broken words that have betrayed your hopes, you will, at some point, in the words of James Hillman, be led down or let down to your own level, betrayed to yourself, where you are alone with God. The last two words were not Hillman's. Then you will find what is your ground, truly. The ground God gives you when words and promises too weak were broken and you are left alone where you cannot stand yourself. This is the place of God behind God. Again, Eckhart's phrase. This is a breakthrough unto a new consciousness. It comes if it comes. It is not automatic. It comes through the broken word, by means of the experience of betrayal. It is the end of childish trust. It is the beginning of humanity, the beginning of love. This does not mean, of course, that every betrayal, another's choice to betray you, was therefore right or good. No, faith like this, if it is a new consciousness, takes you walking on the waters of paradox. It's not your old self. There on the waters of paradox, your own evil, when you see it before God, can become a fulcrum of your own being lifted up, even when the one you crushed may still be suffering. Strange. There, out on the waters of paradox of a new consciousness, the disaster that befalls you through another's broken word can so shift your shape that you are as if newborn. The old life is past and gone. A new life comes. How often shall we forgive, O Lord, says Peter? 7 times a day? No, 70 times 7, says he. This does not come automatically. The gift of God is not a mechanism. Faith is not a transaction. Often, from the thickets of our broken words, we do choose the ruts that we know and the dead-end paths that do not lead up to light. But if you come really to yourself after a broken word, to yourself alone, without fantasy or imagination, you are in the situation of our Lord on that last night. You are ready for the faith of Jesus. It is absolute faith. That is, it has not contents of believing this is so and that is so. It is absolute, an absolute trust in the presence and the gift of your God. Here, you have power and freedom and courage to choose meanings for all that has happened to you. Here is new being. Here, new consciousness, which Christians we call salvation. Here, in Paul Tillich's word, comes a faith which is rooted in the God who appears when God has disappeared in the anxiety of doubt. To receive the Spirit of thankfulness, of reconciliation, of rest, inside relations and events which you have feared or hated, to receive this Spirit has been given one name by our whole tradition of the Hebrew Bible and the Christian: to be blessed. To be blessed. In its darkest, richest vein, deep beneath the surface of our sneezing and our counting, blessing has always meant new freedom to see the work of God unfolding through what is given. If your sorrows have to this day never been touched by blessing, may you hear in the blessing today that God comes down through the broken word in the awful tree. Amen. Let us sing, "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?"